Have you seen the stars tonight? Would you like to go up on a deck and look at them with me? Have you seen the stars tonight?
Paul, welcome.
Good day.
Nice to see you.
Paul Kantner here.
We are here to...
San Francisco calling.
Yeah. We're here to celebrate, among other things, the re-release of one of my favorite albums, and I think one of the best albums to come out of the folk psychedelic Bay Area music scene, Blows Against the Empire. It was an album that certainly changed my life, listening to it in New Jersey. And it was also one of the few albums ever nominated for a Hugo Award, which is the big...
Yeah, it changed my life, too. Me and Grace got together at that point while we were making the album and eventually had China, so that changed my life pretty radically as well. So don't feel left out.
So how did a guy who went to military school and boarding school get into science fiction?
Sikhaya, yeah, good. I got left in the library in the second grade for some obtuse reason, and for an hour or so. And being short and in the second grade, all the science fiction books were on the lowest bottom shelf in the Catholic library, naturally. Only heretic books were probably under the carpet or something. And ran into C.S. Lewis at an early age, and I haven't looked back since, really. So science fiction is a very good both escapist literature and alternate quantum universe, particularly if you're in a Catholic military boarding school and you're not the type that belongs there. Right. Like, I never got a rank in all my years in military school because I just was too much of a fuck-off or something. Didn't get in trouble, but didn't excel in the proper arts either. So C.S. Lewis started it all. And I liked his later when I had children, reading the Narnia series of his. He wrote so many such a varied creature, and so many varied disciplines and religions and beliefs, and the story of taking his wife to Europe when she was dying of cancer, and it is a beautiful, marvelous story. And so I've always been very fond of him, not as a Catholic, but just as a writer. He has a certain elegance as an English writer.
I was wondering if science fiction was one of the things, say, before psychedelics, that turned you into a bohemian.
Saved my fucking life, I'll tell you, starting in the second grade. And then going on through all the classics, Asimovs and Heinleins and things like that, was like... as Jon Stewart said on The Daily Show to Kurt Vonnegut the other night, you saved my life many times during my adolescence with your writings. And it just provided an alternate pathway, I think. And SF, like San Francisco and So Fine, is an excellent path for the short of bank robbery, which was my other in high school, in career day. I had bank robber or suicide to check off on my list there of possible future job prospects. Unfortunately, they didn't have a booth for either one of them at the job fair. So I was left on my own and went to a Catholic college briefly and then transferred to a non-Catholic college and then eventually worked my way back to San Francisco where I was born 2 or 3 years ago.
You were part of the early sort of second generation folk guys too. How did you get into folk music? Because among other
Weavers were an extraordinary influence in my career. Coming upon them and finding them was dramatically impressive to a young white boy from the peninsula and Santa Clara University and things like that and Catholic boarding school.
Our fathers bled at Valley Forge. The snow was red with blood, their faith was warm. At Valley Forge, their faith was brotherhood.
Wasn't that a time to thrive? The soul of man, wasn't that a terrible time?
Just the quality of the music was the first thing, because we were in that folk music mode anyway. It was just starting in those days as I was getting out of high school. And then when the Weavers came onto my particular consciousness, I was just swept away by what they did and how well they did it. and how simple it was, and unpretentious, and good, just basically good, and moving. And I just went from there. And I think that's mostly what I contributed to the Jefferson Airplane, was sort of the Weavers' ethic of how to be a band in terms of benefits, social responsibility, as well as just having a good time and moving among the crowds that be, that were so invigorating. It was like Paris in the 20s, really, for me. San Francisco in the 60s was a moral equivalent, if nothing else.
When did you start hanging out in the Haight?
We didn't get to San Francisco till about 65, 64 maybe. And we got just a commune. We were influenced, again, science fiction-wise, by Robert Heinlein's commune mode in A Stranger in a Strange Land, and tried to sort of live it out in a practical living mode, in terms of having group this and group that and group a money ball, and whoever needed money took it, whoever had money put it in, group food, and that sort of thing. And we found a lot of us living in a nice, I wouldn't call it commune quite, but just a good big flat in the Fillmore District of 10 or 15 rooms for real cheap, because it was in the Fillmore District. My father says, "You're living where?" Turk and Laguna, Dad.
Yeah.
Right next to the pink whatever.
Well, it had at one point been the jazz capital of the world, really, the Fillmore.
Not when we got there. It was pretty much a slum by the time we got there. That's why the rent was cheap, and we went for it. And we never got particularly in any serious trouble. Though we lived over the all-night liquor store in the Fillmore. It never presented much of a problem, potheads that we were. And so we all sort of branched out from there and became part of San Francisco in, I guess, 64, 65.
I was talking with David Crosby last week, and he talked a bit about the house that you guys had with David Freiberg in Venice.
We had several, One was in Venice.
When was that?
A little before 64, maybe 62, 61.
Yeah, and he talked about how much Heinlein had an influence on that household.
Same concept, of communal living. It was the early communes. I think Heinlein, being the Republican fascist that he was, and I love him all the more because being German, blah, blah, blah. But I think he was sort of offended by all the hippies taking up his commune concept and taking it to the nth degree. There is one cute story, though. When I was making Blows Against the Empire, I wrote a letter to Heinlein because I got his address. He lived down in Santa Cruz in Bonnie Doon, actually, where my first girlfriend lived. And so I thought, well, this is propitious. And I sent him a letter asking permission to use some of his words and some of his concepts out of his novels in Blows Against the Empire that I was working on. And he wrote me back saying, "My God, this is staggering," something like that. "People have been ripping off my ideas and words for like 30 or 40 years, and you're the first person who's ever had the decency to call and ask for permission." And then he said, "P.S. And oh, by the way, my gardener says he went to high school with Marty Balin, who's your lead singer right now, and sends his best." And that was a cute letter.
Now, when you guys were creating that household, were there a lot of similar households around in the Bay Area?
No, not that we knew of. Really? When I left Catholic University, Santa Clara, where Yorma went as well, there was a fledgling, burgeoning group of people who went to San Jose State College, which was the alternate quantum college to Santa Clara. It was a party school. It's where all the fuck-offs went, and nobody gave a shit. There was this great burgeoning sort of beatnik community surrounding and exceptional from San Jose State that I fell accidentally into. And ran into any number of good people, from David Freiberg and Crosby to Sherry Snow and who's that guy? Jesse Fuller, Melvina Reynolds, Alice Stewart, and all these people came. And we started a club, actually, in San Jose, a little folk nightclub, and had a great, we would sell like marijuana under the bar.
In San Jose,
on a very amateurish level.
Yeah.
And we started a little music store and gave banjo lessons, and Yorma gave guitar lessons. And it was a nice little community of musicians that extended from San Jose up, actually, in through Palo Alto, a place called The Tangent, into San Francisco at Coffee and Confusion, the Coffee Gallery, and over to Berkeley, a place called The Cabal. There was this little circuit of strange people nightclubs that were let us say, nutritious to the left wing amongst us.
So how did you actually meet David Crosby?
How did I? You know, I don't remember, actually. Mm-hmm. Could have been at the offstage, this place we ran in San Jose. Mm-hmm. He came through playing. Or he was a friend of David Freiberg's on the folk circuit. Mm-hmm. But it was in that era, about 62, that we met.
Did you actually run into any of the original beatniks, like Neil Cassady or Alan?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We used to have a house on Hayes Street of this poet, writer, artist who kept sort of a French kind of kitchen. You know what I'm talking about? Where everybody gathered and chatted. And Neil used to always come by with his girlfriends and go crazy the way Neil did.
Wow.
So I was quite familiar with Neil in those days. This is early. This is even before our communes, actually. Or no, actually, it was after the communes, so 63.
Was that Kenneth Rexroth by any chance?
No, his name was Frank Melton.
What was the spur that made you guys want to pick up electric instruments and play rock and roll?
LSD, probably. Mm-hmm. We were down playing our little folk instruments in San Jose, and one of the one kid who was on a trust fund had enough money to buy a Fender Twin Reverb amp with reverb, right? And you combine that with LSD and marijuana, and then a stage, and you go crazy from there. Whoa, this is psychedelic. Yeah, the Fender Twin Reverb. I treasure it to this day. I try not to play through anything other still than a Fender Twin Reverb, because the reverb is so beautiful.
That's great.
And natural. Every other reverb I've tried does not come close.
Did the Beatles have any effect on you, what you guys were doing?
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Chord changes. Mm-hmm. They changed the whole pop music world, really. Mm-hmm. The Weavers started hinting at it, throwing a few relative minors in mm-hmm. every now and again, white boy kind of shit. Mm-hmm. But the Beatles took it to the nth degree and broke that 1-4-5 kind of and C A minor F G kind of progressions that embodied maybe 90%, if I dare say, of the pop music charts in the '50s. It was, and then one other holdover, the Benny Goodman, what's that thing called? 32 bar kind of things. That was the other basic. And there was like two basics really left by the 50s once Little Richard got in there and Jerry Lee Lewis. And the Beatles broke that mold. Just throwing in the most amazing confluence of chords and melody lines, and had nothing to do with any of that earlier shit. That's why one of the reasons why they broke so free is because they didn't use that. I mean, they used it, but rarely.
In the early days of the Hate, when was the first time when you started to feel like something was happening that had some kind of community importance beyond which, beyond just a cool little neighborhood in San Francisco?
When we were in San Jose, I always had the fond memory of a phrase called Chloe on Noe, who was the marijuana dealer who lived up at the top of Noe Street above the Castro. Or what became the Castro, and she lived with Mike Ferguson, who later became part of the Charlatans, and they were the first progenitors of all of those antique kind of rooms that we have in San Francisco, where we had with the lamps and the couches and all the hoo-ha from the Victorian age, and they dressed in all those charlatan kind of outfits, suits, not quite Western, but Western influence, and all sorts of outfits. So Chloe and Noe was probably my first touch of San Francisco, coming from San Jose, which was like driving into Oz from God knows where. It was always an amazing journey to come from San Jose when we were going to school up to San Francisco. Because it's like you were going to, not to the promised land, but at least to Oz. And you know there was also going to be something going on there that was worthwhile.
And how did you get into psychedelics?
Psychedelics, who gave me Dino Valenti. Actually, we were running our club in San Jose, and he was one of the people who came by and played along with Crosby and others. Melvin Reynolds and blah, blah, blah. Dino Valenti brought these little vials of blue liquid and says, you guys ought to try this. This is interesting. And I took it on Halloween night, I think, in like 1962, maybe, or three, and spent the entire night laying in the back of my Volkswagen bus staring out to the retractable ceiling at the stars. And then it was dawn and time to go to bed. But it was quite an interesting night.
Was there anything about psychedelic experience that reminded you of science fiction, in a sense?
Oh, only that it pushed at the edges. Yeah, I had already been ruined by science fiction, so I was sort of jaded to that sort of experience. So I was a natural for LSD. Fortunately, it didn't make me jump out of windows or do any of those things. and never hardly ever had a bad trip. I think 2 out of 1,000 maybe, and even they weren't that bad.
One of the fantastic...
Oh, it's very educational. I never hallucinated, being German, I guess. And it was always more of a physical and mental kind of situation. I never saw the walls dripping with spiders or any of that sort of thing. It was a great aphrodisiac, number one. It opened your mind to anything like not throwing cigarettes out of cars and keep the land clean and make the air better. And I think it contributed greatly to the whole Sierra Club mentality that grew up in those years. Was greatly enhanced by naive, ignorant, even white, middle-class children being raised in suburbs, not knowing shit. It was a great educational tool.
It worked for me.
It worked for me. Yeah. I mean, and gave me a lot of clarity on certain levels, some of which I'm still working on and probably will continue to. And then it did its thing and you moved on. I can't imagine taking acid again today. It would be sort of, number one, redundant. It opens a certain door, and once that door is open, it's open. You don't have to keep opening it and closing it. And the other thing, it takes so much time to do it right. Like, it's like a half a day, all day trip kind of situation. And it's like, I always liken it to when you're a teenager and in your early 20s, driving to L.A. is quite the adventure in your first or second car. But after about the 15th trip, I'll take PSA. I'll be down there, in 40 minutes, and I can get to work instead of. But the first 12 or 15 trips were quite extraordinary and liberating. Likewise with acid and driving to LA. Both of them had their benefits.